Support for Science Friday comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Joining me again this week is America's engineer, Bill Nye. Good to have you back, Bill.
It's so good to be back, Ira.
Bill, this week the National Climate Assessment came out, and if you're thinking, oh, no, wait, another climate report, I wouldn't blame you, because in less than a year's time, we've seen four different reports, including this one, this new one from the Obama administration. But the question is anyone paying attention?
I'm sorry, what?
Is anyone interested in a new report? Because the Gallup poll out this March showed that the majority of Americans, 60%, do believe in global warming. But in a Pew Research poll ranking priorities, Americans believed that this should be on the minds of Congress and the president. What should they think about? Global warming came in second to last. Now, add this into the mixture, because this gets even more interesting. Renewable energy like solar may become a cross-party issue. I want you to meet the Green Tea Coalition, whose Tea Party members are crossing party lines, and they are supporting Democrats who advocate the use of solar power. That's at least what's going on and may be happening in Florida governor's race. Green Tea Party people coming to talk about this. Is you've talked about global warming for a long time.
For
right?
20 years.
You run into this issue.
Pretty much.
Does it surprise you that people know it's, you know, they believe in it, but they're not talking about it, or they don't find it as a topic to talk about?
It doesn't surprise me. And I would say since the recession of 2008, people have been distracted. And it's a difficult thing to successfully connect tornadoes and hurricanes and warm surface temperatures in people's minds with this background noise. Mm-hmm. People are introducing the idea that scientific uncertainty, the plus or minus quality of scientific investigation into climate, is the same as doubt about the whole thing. And that noise machine has really has been very successful.
Yeah.
But it's in, as I always say, in my opinion, it's in nobody's best interest.
All right, let's bring on some other opinions. Let me introduce my guests. Anthony Leiserwitz is director of the Yale Project on Climate Change at Yale University in New Haven. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Leiserwitz.
Hi, Ira. Hi, Bill. It's great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Cheryl Kirschenbaum is a co-author of Unscientific America, How Science Illiteracy Threatens Our Future, and director of the Energy Poll at the University of Texas at Austin. She joins us from KAZU in Monterey. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Kirschenbaum. Are you there, Cheryl? I think we lost her. We'll see if we can get her back. Tony, let's talk about all these reports about changing the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me on, Ira.
Oh, there you are. Hi, Bill. Oh, there you are.
Greetings.
Let me ask you, Tony, first, are more and more people getting on board with the idea? Is there a disconnect that people, as a survey says, they do believe in it now, but they just don't want to talk about it? What is your polling showing?
Yeah, we show exactly the same thing, that about 63% of Americans accept that it's happening, but only about half understand that it's human caused. And likewise, relatively few Americans are worried about it. And one of the main reasons, and this has been consistent across many years of research, is that for many Americans, if they do accept it, they nonetheless think of it as a distant problem, distant in time, that the impacts won't be felt for a generation or more, and distant in space, that this is about polar bears or small island countries, not the United States, not my state, not my community, not my friends and family or the people and places I care about. So it seems psychologically distant. And that's, however, one of the things that may be starting to change. One, because we've gone through a couple years of just incredibly insane and extreme weather disasters. And we know that many Americans are beginning to connect the dots between climate change and extreme weather. And now comes this week this major report that was congressionally mandated that looks at national climate change or climate change here in the United States and details in great exhaustive detail all the different ways that we can already see that climate change is here and now. It's not far away and distant. We can already see these and feel these impacts right here at home.
Cheryl, do people need more evidence? I mean, or is it a psychological, I just don't want to believe it? I mean, is there a certain amount of evidence that will change or tip that feeling? Cheryl, are you there? I guess we're not hearing. Cheryl, are you there?
Is there an extraordinary delay? No, that's what happened last time she joined in.
That's a very complex question.
There we go.
Well, give me a complex answer then. All right. Until we get our phone line fixed up with Cheryl, let me continue with Tony. Tony, is it people don't have enough information, or what is it? Or they don't want to believe it, or?
Well, I'll underscore what Cheryl just said, even if it was just partial, is that it's complicated. That there are lots of different kinds of Americans. Again, in our work, we've identified what we call global warming six Americas that each respond to this issue very differently. And partly what's going on is some people don't have enough information. So there is still an important role for scientific information. But this issue is also, of course, dramatically affected these days by our politics. And, you know, there's a number of people in this country who are deeply dismissive and hostile to this issue, mostly because they're really afraid of the potential policy response, that they see this is an issue that we cannot solve just simply through voluntary action. It's going to require national collective action and state-level action and community-level and, yes, global action. And that really scares many of them because they see that as a pretext for more government. And what they're particularly afraid of is the taking away of Americans' individual liberties. And so they're deeply suspicious of this issue and of those people who keep talking about how important it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it this idea of the conspiracy? There's a conspiracy of scientists who publish report after report.
They just want money.
That's right. Because some of those guys, I have met those scientists. A lot of them will drive like a Honda Accord, you know, they're just out of hand, the way the money rolls in.
Not a Mercedes that they're driving around.
Oh, yeah, no, we live well.
No. My point being that it's a very hard thing for people who believe a government should be absolutely as small as possible, to just decrease it. And so that means fewer and fewer regulations, and that is ultimately probably not going to work, as mm-hmm. you point out.
Mm-hmm. Tony, though, but there sort of seems to be a strange little coalition. I mentioned this at the beginning about clean energy as sort of a uniting factor for people on both sides of the climate issue. I've talked about the Green Tea Coalition. Sounds crazy.
Right. Yeah.
Talk about that a little.
Who would have thunk it? Yeah. So basically in the state of Georgia, the Sierra Club partnered with the Georgia Tea Party. And so I'll just say that again. The Sierra Club partnered with the Georgia Tea Party to do a fight against the state-owned or the state monopoly, Georgia Power. And basically, the monopoly did not want to have to accept solar power, electricity being produced by homeowners off their rooftops into the grid, and have to accept that because they're naturally a monopoly that wants to be the sole owner and producer and distributor of electricity. Those two different groups joined forces in order to force the utility to change their policy, and they won. They succeeded. And not only did they succeed, but they found that so successful that they have gone on to create what they call the Green Tea Party. Now, does that mean that they agree about everything? Of course not. The Sierra Club's totally against the proposed nuclear power plant in Georgia. Tea Party, as I understand it, are still very much for it. But nonetheless, and this kind of is a microcosm of what we see nationally, is that Americans as a whole are strongly endorsed across party lines, liberals, conservatives, this transition that I think as a country we all know we need to do is make a transition towards a clean energy future. It doesn't make sense for us to still be beholden to an energy system that basically was invented in the 1700s and 1800s. Digging stuff out of the ground and setting it on fire to power our lives, it's time to form an energy system that's worthy of the 21st century. At the same time, recognizing that this is a big undertaking. I mean, this is the lifeblood of our society, of our whole civilization is built on the use and exploitation of fossil fuels. So it's going to take a while. But nonetheless, I think there's broad-based consensus that we need to get started or mm-hmm. need to accelerate our progress.
Mm-hmm. The problem, though, is still, let me ask, I mean, it's... I have a house in Los Angeles that has solar panels, and the Department of Water and Power accepts my electricity, and they regulate it. This problem is still storage, right? I mean, we're a long way from this, but where we'd have so much electricity produced renewably that we need it at night, and there's no way to get it right now. I mean, you can get it at dawn and dusk with wind. You can get it with solar panels, photovoltaics during the day. But we still need this big idea of storage. Is that true, or is that my engineering perspective?
No, I think you're exactly right, that storage is really the key linchpin, because once that is solved, basically one of the major constraints on the very rapid deployment of clean energy gets solved, because as you point out, the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. There are ways around some of that. So, for instance, here on the East Coast, they're talking about a string of offshore wind farms up and down the East Coast, because the wind is always blowing somewhere. And if those are connected together in, using a smart grid, then as long as the wind is blowing somewhere, there's always going to be energy coming into that system for distribution. So there are other ways around this. But nonetheless, storage is definitely one of the key, watch this space, because it's going to be very exciting.
Storage and
years.
Transmission, right? I mean, if you things thousands of nautical miles apart, it's hard to, you're going to have losses down transmission lines.
But people are asking to do that. I mean, it's showing to be economically a winner. I mean, we did a story on Iowa becoming a huge wind power state.
I was in Iowa earlier last year.
All the political differences go away when you start making money. You know, the incentive tax credit. Everybody's in favor of that now, because we make our own wind turbines there. So it's a really interesting story. We're gonna take a break and come back and talk lots more about this. And we'll look at Cheryl Kirschenbaum. She's back on the line with us. And we'll also Tony Lazaritz with me. Also, is Bill Nye, the science guy. Take the calls on 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow with my host, Bill Nye, co-hosting here with me. We're talking this hour about climate change and what Americans think about it with my guest, Anthony Lazaritz. He is director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. Also, Cheryl Kirschenbaum, co-author of Unscientific America, How Science Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. She's director of the Energy Poll at the University of Texas at Austin. Let's talk about the Energy Poll. You've surveyed Republicans and Democrats, Cheryl, on whether they'd be willing to switch to LEDs, get a hybrid car, and so on. And what did you find?
Well, looking at the data, what we saw is that while Democrats may be a bit more likely to say that they're willing to change their behaviors to be more energy efficient, it's actually Republicans who are more often the ones that have already done this. And I think that hits on the head that our decisions, while a lot of people do care about the environment, decisions are primarily based on economics. And, I mean, it's the same with when we take action to be more energy efficient. You were just talking about turbines. And we see states like Massachusetts, which is traditionally a very green state, arguing for years over whether or not to get wind energy up off the coast of Nantucket, and states like Texas, which might not have the greenest reputation, doing all they can to get offshore wind built as fast as they can because they traditionally see energy as an economic driver in that state. So, I mean, when it comes down to it, people care most. They prioritize what affects them personally and what affects their wallet.
So in the case of conservatives, they have the resources to buy a $10 light bulb instead of a 99-cent light bulb, for example.
Yes.
So they'll invest in that, whereas progressives or what have you will say, well, I want to do that, but they don't get around to it. Yeah, that's cool.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Right. Can I add to that?
Sure, Tony. Go ahead.
We see the same pattern in our data as well, though we do find that many progressives have invested in those same energy saving. But I think beyond just the bottom, the pocketbook issue, there's also a deeper level of values. And we know that many conservatives, I mean, remember, the core word of conservative is conserve. And that one of the things that they really are, very against is waste. Independence, self-reliance, and not wasting are all core values of conservatism. I mean, let's go all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt. It was Teddy Roosevelt who said, unrestrained exploitation of our country's natural resources has to stop, that we have to go to a sustainable use. And I think that kind of notion of conserving what makes this country great is at the core of much conservative ideology. And I think in part that translates into their actual energy use and other types of behavior.
Does it appear that the states, although we talked about Iowa and other states in this wind tunnel that goes from North Dakota to Texas, are they discovering this on their own? That, hey, you know, there's money to be made in these alternatives. We can get jobs. I think in Iowa they're building their own wind turbine blades and things. Is that how it's working, slowly percolating up without having to have, you know, the people conceive that the government is ramming this down their throats?
So my understanding of a lot of this is that it's kind of a combination of both bottom-up as well as top-down. So let's just take Texas as an example. I mean, Texas is one of the biggest wind-producing states in the country, wind energy producing. That was a program started under Governor George W. Bush and continued by Governor Rick Perry, neither of whom are known as, you know, strong progressives. Nonetheless, they saw this as a great opportunity to harness some of the great resources right there in Texas. And one of the other things, and this is back to Cheryl's point about economics, but also about resilience, that many farmers, for instance, are finding that by putting turbines on their land, when the next drought hits and they suddenly lose the income they were getting from their farmland, the wind still blows, and they're able to ride through those really tough times because they're getting a second source of income. And that's really changing the equation, in fact, really helping to reinvigorate the economies of many of these small farming communities across the Great Plains.
Mm-hmm. Using their real estate to make money. So there's
because you can still you can still grow crops. You just plow around the wind turbine.
When you see a map that just came out this week from the president's this last study, it's not the first map we've seen, but when you see a map that shows that in a few years, I mean a few decades, Florida mostly is going to be underwater. I mean, how much of Florida is going to be underwater? Don't the people in Florida realize that this is something that is local? And it's going to affect the, you know, their vacation homes, their profits, their crops, things like that.
I would say that some people see it, but what we see in our data is that attitudes really shift with the weather. So when we had those huge droughts and awful hot long summer in 2012, we saw a huge jump from 65% of Americans saying climate change is occurring to 73%. And with this long cold winter that we just had in many parts of the U.S., those who think it's occurring is down to 68%. And it's such a politically charged issue that falls along party lines. I mean, we have 85% of Democrats versus 47% of Republicans say that climate change is occurring. So it's just, it's an emotional issue, and there's so much more involved than just presenting the data or the maps or whatever, you know, given report comes out.
So we did not, from my side of it, as science educators, we did not connect the polar vortex to climate change.
I wish we did.
Yeah,
not well enough. I would also just point out, though, in Florida, this is an ongoing and evolving discussion. And in fact, the four southernmost counties, you know, Broward, Miami-Dade, et cetera, I mean, there are three Republican leaders of those counties and one Democrat, and they've joined together in a Southeast Compact to start addressing very seriously the issue of vulnerability to climate change, because they have to. It's not just that Miami is probably the most vulnerable city on the planet. Okay, let me say that.
What about New Orleans?
Not as much as Miami.
Really?
Because
that makes sense, actually, yeah.
Not only is Miami at sea level, but the entire southern part of Florida is built on rock that is essentially Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
So the inundation of water through the groundwater is going to be a major serious problem. I mean, Miami already floods when there's even just a small storm.
Well,
so, yeah, they've got serious problems.
What about the role of the media in drawing any attention to this? Do you have any surveys or polling or get any idea from talking to people whether this is not hardly on their radar screen?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the other key thing. So Bill mentioned the economy, and certainly the economy has been a huge factor. But the other is media attention. And our colleagues, Max Boykoff out in Colorado, tracks media coverage. And he finds that newspaper coverage from basically 2007, which was kind of the high water mark of public engagement, to 2010, which was the bottom, it dropped by 2/3. And nightly network news coverage, like the CBS Evening News, dropped 90%.
Well, here's what I always say about that, everybody. In my opinion, you can't blame the media. The media reflects what people want to watch. Now, there's a few exceptions to that. But I think that when the media coverage drops because people's interest in the story drops.
Go ahead, Cheryl.
Well, if I may, I think it's also really important to highlight the way that the media has changed. So a lot of traditional science journalists, science reporters, have lost their jobs. And we have a different kind of media through blogging and through, you know, all of these different online means, telling these stories in ways that, you know, don't necessarily reflect reality or feel that they have to tell both sides of a debate that doesn't actually exist. And it gets compounded by the 24-hour news cycle and what's going to draw attention. And so we see things like leading up to the last presidential election, I think it was something like Joe Biden's smile got 3 times as much coverage as climate change if you don't count MSNBC. I mean, what hits our radar isn't necessarily the stuff that's going to be impacting the way we live. It's the stuff that's going to get clicks and hits and eyeballs.
The president, in fact, this week had to go around the mainstream media and go right to the weathermen, the weather people who do the weather reports on television. It was Al Roker, other people like that, because they felt that they were not getting any coverage on climate change issues. And I was a little bit amused by that because I know a few weather people who don't believe in climate change themselves.
I know one, yeah.
Yeah,
no, it's really troubling. But also in the case of Al Roker and Sam over at ABC, these guys, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but they're very concerned about climate change. And the man, that is to say management, discourages it. Because people have introduced this idea of controversy. Now, we can complain about this. What we want to do is come up with ways to, if I may, enlighten people about the seriousness of this problem.
Mm-hmm.
Do your polls show us a way forward? Is there a tactic, a strategy that emerges by studying these data?
There is, and actually I'll go straight back to the weathercasters. So we ask Americans, where do you get your news and information from? It's not the New York Times. It's not the Washington Post. It's not CBS News. It's not even Fox News. It's, for most Americans, it's local television news.
Yeah, still.
And what's the main reason they tune into local television news? Is the weather report. And weather and climate are intimately related. So over the past 5 years, we, along with partners at George Mason University, Climate Central, NOAA, NASA, the American Meteorological Society, and the National Weather Association, have been building a national support system to bring broadcast meteorologists into this discussion. Because unlike climate scientists who have day jobs and go out and talk to 100 people here and 100 people there, they don't reach 300 million American adults every day. But weathercasters have the eyes and ears and, most importantly, the trust of literally hundreds of millions of Americans. And so we believe that they're actually a really important set of communicators to talk about this, to place, you know, the recent weather experience or hot heat wave or flood that one has seen in one's own region into this broader national and global context of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we see that people want to hear it from them.
Cheryl, you served as a Florida senator's science advisor.
Mm-hmm.
Could more scientists follow in your footstep now that the professor jobs are getting harder to come by?
Oh, you hit the nail on the head. I couldn't agree with that more. So what really gets me is that if you don't pursue a tenure-track trajectory out of getting your PhD from graduate school, it's considered this alternative career track, when the truth is exactly what you said. We have more PhDs than ever before and fewer positions available in the ivory towers. And science is changing and shaping the way we live. It's, you know, inherently related to every significant challenge we face, like climate change, like ocean acidification, like all of these big issues. And we need science ambassadors, like Bill Nye and like you, Ira. We need people who have the expertise and can tell these stories. And what really startled me when I got to Congress was how few people in these congressional offices have any kind of science background. And they might be extremely smart, but the truth is, and this is what we don't often think about when we're in our bubble talking about these issues within our own communities, there are so many anti-science groups, pseudoscience groups, making the rounds on Capitol Hill that are really funny and articulate and have PhDs behind their names and might not be scientific experts, but it doesn't matter. They're telling the opposite story, and they sound credible. And a lot of scientists don't know how to come to the Hill. They're treated as a special interest group. They're not taken seriously. They don't have a take-home message. They hand out some PowerPoint slides to staffers, and they think they've done their job. So we need to be training tomorrow's Renaissance scientists to get interested in policy or, you know, public speaking. Maybe scientists who speak another language could do a lot. Scientists interested in media. We need to create these ambassadors if we're really going to change the culture, and that's at the heart of this challenge.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Cheryl Kirschenbaum and Tony Lizeritz, and with me is Bill Nye, the science guy. That sounds like a big challenge, Cheryl, to change
no problem.
That kind of culture. Bill, you've been up on Capitol Hill.
I was there earlier this week. Yes, I was.
And so what do you tell them? Do they listen, or is it, you know, just basically who you happen to talk to?
Well, I will say universally, the staffers, especially the senior staffers, like the chief of staff for a congressman or a senator, are often just brilliant people, people who keep track of a zillion things. And climate change is just one more issue on their long list. And so what you do is you keep the pressure on. Now, this is easy enough to say, but what I recommend to everybody, if you're of a mind and you're inclined, is visit your representative, your senator, your congressperson in your home district. That is to say, going to Capitol Hill is good. You got to set up a meeting. You got to get all organized. But when you have access to your member, to your Congress, member of Congress or senator, is when he or she is at home.
And this is an election year. Good
yeah.
time to do
well,
that.
Well, if it's not an election year, it's always next year. I mean, so several of the chiefs of staff told us that. That the time to get access to the actual guy or gal is at home.
Mm-hmm. When they're in their district out campaigning.
And if I might just add to that, if you think about the portion of our federal budget that goes toward research and development, or essentially the science stuff, it's only a fraction of the total, and it's decreasing. So in the late 1960s, after everyone talks about the launch of Sputnik, when Kennedy and Eisenhower had their scientific advisors in their cabinets, it was 12% of the federal budget. And today that number is just 3.4%. So if a nation's priorities can be illustrated by where we spend our tax money, then right now we're just not that focused on finding the solutions we need.
And I remind everybody, investment in science and basic research is what keeps the United States in the game economically. Now, am I on a soapbox? In other words, the United States doesn't manufacture things and export them the way it did when I was a kid. Instead, the United States innovates. The United States invents the internet, mobile phones, extraordinary smartphones, and so on. Ways to to feed more people with the same amount of arable land. And this comes from basic investment. And if we could invent the better battery or the amazing hot salt heat storage system, we could again lead the world and perhaps be manufacturers. So one of the things we talk about is the space program, Ira. What was different in the 1960s is we had this Cold War going on to get to the moon, and you did not have to have everybody running around saying STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. It was organic. Mm-hmm. And so my claim is that if we were to invest in space a little more and a little more smartly, we would have this inherent expectation that science is a worthy investment.
Yeah, we've run out of time. I'd like to thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Cheryl Kirschenbaum, co-author of Unscientific America, How Science Literacy Threatens Our Future. She's director of the Energy Poll at the University of Texas at Austin. Anthony Lizeritz is director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Education at Yale University problem with change communication at Yale University in New Haven. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks,
for
Ira.
Having-